From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, high hopes for a seed accelerator linking universities with Milwaukee area companies. Later, a unique exhibit at the Phyllis Harris Museum celebrates a unique theatrical form.
No is the longest continuous theater in the world. It has been performed from the 14th, 15th century AD on without a break.
Plus, a Waukesha writer remembers years of trips to the Boundary Waters. And Milwaukee singer-songwriter Peter Mulvey exercises some songwriting muscle with his latest album.
I've been writing a lot lately. The past couple of years, I've been writing a song every Tuesday. And I knew that I wanted to make just sort of a knockdown, drag-out kind of a record. It's more that you just put that in the back of your mind, and then your muse, whatever you want to call it, coughs up some rock and roll tunes.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. Two key organizations focused on innovation and the Milwaukee economy are teaming with nearly two dozen colleges and universities on plans for a so-called seed accelerator they hope will make waves. The project got officially off the ground last week with a meeting of the academic institutions involved. Milwaukee Business Journal reporter and occasional Lake Effect innovation and technology contributor Allison Botter covered the story, and she joins us now to explain more. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch.
What is the significance of this so-called seed accelerator within an academic context?
Right. So the idea is that there's 20 colleges, universities, technical colleges from around the region that have been brought in to potentially participate. And it would take student ideas, maybe these sort of startup or early stage company seeds of ideas, and bring them together with the resources to make it into a fully fledged company.
Who brings this to bear? Is it just the collaboration, or is it some other group of people that's good at this stuff?
Right. So this idea started with Startup Milwaukee, which is the group that runs the 96 Square co-working space downtown. The idea kind of took root there, and then Michael Hostad over at the Greater Milwaukee Committee's Innovation in Milwaukee Initiative was the one who partnered with him, who then reached out in this long chain to Mike Lovell, who's recently moved from UWM over to Marquette University. With basically those three guys in place, they kind of took this idea and brought it to the table to all these other academic institutions.
How important is that mobility that we, you mentioned Michael Hostad moving from place to place, Michael Lovell has moved from place to place. Is that one of the things that sort of drives this spirit of collaboration?
Absolutely. Mike Lovell has always had this sort of collaboration, underlying everything he's done from the beginning here, looking to businesses as partnerships, looking to other universities, not just his own. This is kind of a continuation of ideas that he's had for a long time, and that now that he's in this new position, can work with someone he's worked with before in Michael Hostad, as well as that startup community.
Well, what do colleges and universities stand to get out of the concept? I mean, why isn't it just a Marquette thing?
Well, the idea is that this is for regional economic development and, of course, for the students. You know, a lot of students might have the ideas or the talents, but not the resources to get a business started or to get the kind of training that they would get out of this. So the idea is, okay, maybe not every single one will become a full-fledged business, but it's great training for the students, and it's a great way to connect talent in the region.
And presumably people in the community at large see this as a broader benefit to the overall economic health of the Milwaukee area?
Right. And in the business community particularly, I should say there's a second track to this program. There's that seed accelerator and then what they're calling a corporate talent initiative. Now, that track is more of taking these student talents, these kind of startup ideas and what you'd call, innovative thinking, and bringing it to these big companies, helping them with R&D, helping them with development of ideas and really connecting those dots between the business community and these, hubs of young, innovative talent in the universities.
Does this speak to the challenge of brain drain in a community like Milwaukee?
I think that would be one of the end goals. It hasn't been a stated goal for the organizers, but certainly in Milwaukee, we've seen, so many great academic institutions here that, slowly lose those student minds as they graduate. So one would hope that if they can engage with the business community, engage with maybe their own businesses here, they may want to stick around the area.
Well, and so if that's not a stated goal of the organizers of this, what do we know about what their stated goals are?
Right. Well, that goes back to that idea of, you know, helping the students and helping that broader kind of regional economic development goal.
So what kind of buy-in is there to this? Who's on board?
Right. So we've got that Innovation in Milwaukee, which is out of the Greater Milwaukee Committee. In addition to that, we have 20 regional universities, and that includes every university except for the Milwaukee School of Engineering. And I'm told they may yet kind of jump in on this. The real challenge is going to be, you know, now that we've got all these people at the table, all these institutions, you know, how many will actually come together and participate in the end product? So it's at the very early stages right now, and they've yet to reach out to the business community and formally bring them together. But the idea is that this will come together by mid-November, so we'll see how that goes.
Right. So what has to happen next?
Right. So next, they've had this what they call this academic summit of all these regional institutions. Next comes more of a business side summit, bringing together these companies who have a vested interest in this kind of talent and these kinds of entrepreneurial seeds.
Well, and have the companies? Do they say they're lacking in this area?
Certainly in the past, you know, I've spoken on Lake Effect to Bonnie North about a story we did on innovation and how a lot of these corporations, Manpower Group, Briggs & Stratton among them, are really looking for these new ideas from, you know, young kind of tech-savvy minds that can jumpstart what they're doing in these kind of older entrenched companies.
So are these organizations and institutions inventing something, or is this a model that's existed elsewhere? I put it in a national context for us.
I mean, nationally, there are some sort of templates for this. There's some schools that are doing similar, within a given university, a seed accelerator like this. But in terms of this regional collaboration and on the level, it's unprecedented just in Wisconsin and also nationally.
I feel like I've done an interview about the state's efforts to help accelerate projects coming out of the University of Wisconsin, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that, in the final form of this, we may see some state buy-in. At this point, they aren't saying where the funding will come from. They are assuring it's not from the universities. And they're saying that, you know, we've got this in the bag. We'll find a way to fund it.
We will be watching the next developments closely, and hopefully you might be able to help us keep track. Allison Botter, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
Allison Botter covers technology and innovation, among other things, for the Milwaukee Business Journal. There's a link to her article on the University Seed Accelerator from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. An unusual collection of prints is on display at the Villa Terrace Decorative Arts Museum. We'll meet the owners of the collection when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. An exhibit on right now at Milwaukee's Villa Terrace Decorative Arts Museum casts a spotlight on one of the world's oldest forms of theater. No Theater in the Woodblock Prints of Tsukioka Kogyo is just that, a collection of unique prints that depict characters from plays in traditional costume. They date back to the late 19th and early 20th century, and they're from the private collection of Richard and May Smetherst of Pittsburgh. Anna Marie Sawkins is one of the exhibit's curators. She and the Smethersts met with Lake Effect's Bonnie North at the museum, and May Smetherst began by explaining the significance of No Theater.
No is the longest continuous theater in the world. It has been performed from the 14th, 15th century AD on without a break. So it differs from all the other theaters. It is, compared to kabuki, very austere, very slow, very elegant, and it consists of dance and chant by two or more actors who come onto a stage that is undecorated except for a pine tree in the back, and a prop occasionally, which you can see in the Kogyo prints.
There was a sword or a saber of some kind.
Mm-hmm. There's a chorus that sits on stage left of eight or more men. Today, there are some women performing, which is quite exciting. This has happened recently. There are three or four instrumentalists. The no plays themselves come from various sources. So you have military, you have love stories, tragedies, not realistic at all.
Okay, so very stylized.
Very stylized. When I say austere, they are stylized. And the beauty comes to the audience through the costumes, through the chant, through the dance, and through a special aura that is created between the actor and the audience. It's almost like a religious experience.
I tend to think of no as being formal. Is it a formal?
Very formal, yes. Okay. In fact, what we have today is the same as was the style in the 14th, 15th century, except then it was much faster moving. Still, the style was that prescribed by Zayomi, okay, the best-known author and playwright.
So this collection of prints that you have depict different, I'm assuming different characters and different stories that happen in the No Theater. And Richard, how did you first, and you and May first, get involved in collecting these? What got you interested in it?
As fairly clear, studies the No Theater. She's written books which were beyond display, in which she compares Greek tragedy and Japanese No, which is and finds both similarities and differences, as you might expect. Because May has been studying No for 30, 40 years, as you know, there are very, you mentioned Kabuki before. If you think about pre-modern, pre-19th century Japanese woodblock prints, you think of the Kabuki theater being the very, very common thing, actors to be portrayed. Very few of the No Theater. So we, really, May, started looking around for representations of the No Theater, and she found them.
We were collecting modern Japanese woodblock prints and art. And we went from gallery to gallery, and we were in Kyoto. And we saw nothing this time that we particularly liked. You know, as Dick said, there were all these kabuki prints and paintings. And I said to the owner of the gallery, "Don't you have anything on No?" And he said, "Just a minute." And he went into the back room and he brought out 50 or 60 Kogyo. And I said, "Oh, they're exquisite. They're beautiful. And these are of No plays, some of which I've written about or translated. This is so exciting." And asked how much they were. They were very inexpensive. We bought, how many was it?
20.
20. And he was so thrilled he threw in five for nothing.
Because no one was interested.
Because no one was interested. This is between the time of the famous Hiroshige Hokusai and later artists.
It so was we're talking transition. 1850s?
The turn of the century.
That they were created, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Early 20th century.
Okay.
So we bought these 20. I mean, it was not a lot of money. It was enough. And we went to Tokyo, and we met someone who has a gallery in New York. And we asked her, because you sell Japanese prints, know of Kogyo? And she said, "Oh, yes, I have some that I just bought." And then she said, "I'd sell them to you." And we asked, "And how much?" And she said, "Well, special price." And it was hundreds of dollars. We hadn't spent $100 any one of them. Yeah. So we took a train back to Kyoto, went to the gallery. They were all gone. Everyone he had shown us. All of a sudden, there was a market.
What you see here is a woman who created a market.
So it was all because you were interested, and all of a sudden...
Not really, but that's exaggerating,
like, yeah.
Yes. But what's amazing is that all these museums in Japan and in the United States owned sets of Kogyo, and they didn't know it.
In the late 19th, early 20th century, there seems to have been a great interest in Kogyo. If you go, I mean, the Chicago Institute of Art Institute, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, the Metropolitan Museum in New York, many, many of the major museums of America and of Europe own Kogyo sets, which they must have bought probably 100 years ago or 80 years ago, but they didn't know it. And they sat in the coffers unlooked at, and all of a sudden, the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a renewed interest in this. And part of this comes about, if we may pat our backs a little, by the website that we have. The University of Pittsburgh Library has a website, and if you go to your computer, internet, and type in Kogyo at Pitt, this will come up. And they've made digital photographs of two sets of Kogyo prints, many of which are, all of which are represented here in this exhibition.
Obviously, they are prints, and he would have made, as you say, sets of them. How many are extant, do you know? You don't know. So we have no clue.
No, yeah. we don't know. Right.
So there could be more out there?
Oh, I'm certain there are.
We were sitting one night watching TCM, and a movie came up, and it was Bell, Book, and Candle, which, as you may know, stars Kim Novak and Jimmy Stewart and Jack Lemmon. And she's a witch who falls in love with a commoner. And in the office, in the Jimmy Stewart character's office, the walls are decorated by Kogyo prints.
I'd really like to check out the gossip that Hollywood liked them.
Yeah. Well, there's your next book.
Well, but, you know, it's hard. We tried going in, asking people, you know, find out who the art director of Bell, Book, and Candle was, and find out if anybody knew anything about him. It's very, very difficult to come up with information. Mm-hmm. The Los Angeles County Museum has Kogyo, so there may be a connection. But so maybe we need to contact the curator there.
Maybe, and that's your next piece of the puzzle.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I wanted to interrupt because the prints in Sunday in New York were of Kilgan, and Kilgan is the comic version of No.
And so there's a difference. Yeah.
There's a difference in their prints of Kilgan and No in the exhibit here.
Kilgan, which means crazy words, develops at the same time as No out of the same origins, and that they go in totally different directions. One becomes this formal, austere and elegant form. The other becomes literally, you know, it's really comic words. You can sit and laugh, even knowing the Japanese that we know, which isn't, she knows more classical Japanese than I do. But you can sit there and listen to it and get the jokes.
So Anne-Marie, I'm going to bring you in now as the curator. When did you first see this collection, and what made you want to bring it here to Milwaukee?
Well, I actually was in Pittsburgh in 2007, visiting Martha Chaiklin, former curator of the Milwaukee Public Museum and co-curator of this exhibition. And through Martha, I met the Smethurst, and actually their collection was on display at the Frick Museum. And I just loved it and thought this would be great in Milwaukee.
So what is it about the quality of the art? We're looking at a couple right now behind us, and we were looking at some as we walked in. They are exquisite.
Yes, they are.
And the colors are just amazing, to think that they're prints.
Right. And each color requires a different block in the printing process. So I would say it's about color, form, costume, theater. I mean, there's just so much in these prints that they're just a delight to see.
And they're good sized, too. I mean, at least the ones we're looking at here.
This is a standard size.
Is this the standard? Okay.
Yes.
Because they really allow you to see the detail. Do you have any idea how long it took him to make a print?
Well, Kogyo did not make the prints. He created a painting, and he would then send the painting to the publisher. And the publisher had block cutters and inkers who actually cut all these different blocks that Anne-Marie was talking about and inked them and ran them off. So it was a double process. I would say that Kogyo, in fact, did not see himself primarily as a printmaker. He saw himself as a painter, because everything that he did was painting, and other people did the printmaking.
And so we have some anonymous people to thank for the beauty of the printmaking.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
That's the standard division of labor when it comes to woodblock printmaking.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Because these are exquisite. I mean, the actual technique to just make the print. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that they started as paintings. You know, I thought the print was the original thing. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. How much is in your collection right now, and are you always looking for more?
We have 260.
Something like that. Yes.
Yes. We have some paintings, but most are prints. And of course we're looking for more.
are there gaps in your collection that you hope to fill, like certain characters that you're missing?
Yes. We have a list of all the plays in a particular catalog that comes from Japan, from the Mizuta Museum. And we want to fill in the ones we don't have. Most of the ones we don't have are these vertical.
The horizontal ones, the Nogakuzue, they're 261 prints. The vertical ones are only 110, I believe, in the set.
And I just wanted to add, there are 54 prints in the exhibition, and the exhibition also includes a video of the famous Dojoji performance. So people will actually be able to see a performance on video, and also we have a no mask in the exhibition as well.
I was going to say, because that's part of it, is masks are...
Yes, yeah. Yes, I didn't mention the mask. Some of the actors wear masks, others don't. But certainly if you have a woman, because the actors were male, or a god, or a demon, a mask would be essential.
Do you collect those as well, or are you just mostly focusing on the prints?
We don't.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that is an art form in itself. The carvers of masks are known as particularly famous artists.
I just want to ask you both, what do you hope that audiences come away with when they come to see this exhibition here at the Villa Terrace?
You may go first.
Well, first of all, Kokyo is an artist. We want them to go away with an appreciation for the beauty of the pictures that he created.
And yet it's very important for everyone to recognize that these are not like camera images of No. There's a lot of inventiveness in these.
One of the things I love about Japanese woodblock prints is the perspective, the creativity, the overlapping, the angles. It's very different from what you see in Western art. And so it's just spectacular.
Yeah, it is, and very much worth coming to see. And I cannot thank you, Richard and May Smethurst, enough for taking some time out. I know you've got to get back to getting the show hung and all of that. And I want to thank you for talking about this and for letting your collection come here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure to...
Thank you very much.
Anna Marie Sawkins is one of the curators of the exhibit No Theater in the Woodblock Prints of Tsukioka Kogyo, on at the Villa Terrace Decorative Arts Museum. The prints are from the collection of Richard and May Smethurst. The three of them spoke with Bonnie North as the exhibit was about to open last month. It's open through mid-October. Another break now, and then the author of a recent memoir on a family's trips to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in northern Minnesota. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Summer, waning as it may be, is a time for things like hiking, swimming, canoeing, family vacations, and sometimes all of the above. For Waukesha writer Jim Landwehr, the best place to pursue all of those activities is the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in far northern Minnesota. Landwehr's been going to the Boundary Waters for decades, and for a while, it was a family tradition that he and his brothers would take canoe trips together. He details the lessons he learned on these trips, from the importance of a clean shirt to the importance of family, in a recent memoir called Dirty Shirt, a Boundary Waters memoir. Back last month, Landwehr told Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce about what first drew him to the Boundary Waters.
It was this super remote allure of the area. It was, and the boat motors were allowed, but there weren't very many there. It was just a rustic terrain, just an adventure, I guess. And the weather we had up there was just kind of added to the whole mystique of it. And it just it made me want to go back further north and into rougher conditions just to see if I could do it.
One of the interesting things about this book is you never quite describe yourself as an expert outdoorsman, yet you take these really big outdoors challenges on going into this relative wilderness.
Yeah, it was, again, it really began with my dad going up there in the past and kind of, you know, wanting to walk in his footsteps in some respects. And it was also a challenge by, you know, friends and brothers to, could we really rough it and could we do it well and could we do it right? And we did a little of both. We did it right and we did it wrong, but we learned along the way too, so.
You mentioned your brothers, and a big portion of the book is dedicated to the trips that you made with them. But there's another reason, too, why you wrote this book.
Yeah, there was. It was about brotherhood and about bonding and that kind of things with other family members. But it was really written, you know, for an audience of families. Originally, it was supposed to be just my family stories written down for posterity, and it kind of took on a life of its own to where my writing instructor said, would you like to take this to the wider world? And I said, well, do you think it would sell? And she said, sure. And she said, there's family elements in there, there's adventure in there, there's bonding. She said it would appeal to not just outdoors lovers, but to family people who love family and love relationships. So,
well, I want to go back to some of your early camping and canoeing adventures in the Boundary Waters canoe area. Some of these early trips were less fortunate than the later ones. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the important nature lessons you learned during some of these early trips.
I guess the first one we learned was just a healthy respect for the water, knowing that when we went out the first time, it was on a river system, and thinking that, you know, this is adventure and it's running the rapids as part of that adventure. Well, if you don't run the rapids right, you will pay a price for the rest of the trip. And so that was our first exposure, was just doing it wrong can make your life miserable. So we learned from that, and then we went ahead and continued to learn and grow as we went. But the other item that we learned was just that things that matter back home don't matter up in the woods. What matters is keeping dry, keeping warm, helping each other out. Things that you take for granted at home, but along with that, you don't have the stresses of some of the things you have in city urban life as well. So as we went, we learned a little bit from each of those adventures, and we got better at it as we went along.
You hadn't finished the first trip.
Right, right. I had to turn back with a friend, and this guy went ahead with another friend, and they finished it, and we went back, and he said, if you're not all right with that, let's go back and do it again. It was really kind of a relief to myself to be able to actually finish what we had started a year before.
Why was it so important to you to finish that?
Well, for me especially, being that I thought I was the most outdoorsy of them all. And so when I didn't make it the first trip, I was like, well, I can do better than this. And I was out to prove it to myself, prove it to them, and to prove it to my family as well in some respects. And to, even though my dad wasn't around, just to be able to say, yeah, I did do it. And, you know, I think he would have been proud of that, I guess.
Tell us about, then, the genesis of the brothers' trips.
Those came out of a discussion we had. I think we were at a bar somewhere, and somebody said, well, what do you think about going up to the Boundary Waters together and fishing and stuff? And we all kind of agreed that might be kind of fun, because we had kind of been disconnected through the high school years, and this was a good way to regroup in our college years and just kind of hang out for a week. And so we all love to fish. We all love the outdoors. Not having grown up with a dad, we kind of thought, well, this would be a good chance to maybe learn a little bit about what he saw in the area. And so it just kind of took on a life of its own, on top of being able to reconnect once a year to go a little bit deeper below the surface than, hey, how's the weather? Merry Christmas, you know, kind of the holiday greetings. And find out what's really going on in our lives. So it was a connection point, too, for us.
What did you learn about your family?
I learned that as much as we have our own unique characteristics and differences, that really the only ones we have is each other when it comes right down to it. Growing up in a single-parent family, that was, you know, kind of an undercurrent the whole time. But this kind of made us realize that even though we have our quibbles and our gripes and some of our past history, that really when you get right down to it, we're going to be there for each other. And it proved itself later in life, obviously, with some of the later book stuff. So it was really a cementing of something that we knew was there anyways, but it really helped, I think, in the brothers anyways, bring us together like nothing else could have.
Do you think you found out there in the Boundary Waters what had appealed to your father?
Absolutely. I think we did, because it takes you to a spot that is so remote that all you have is what you hear, see, and taste. And you have a lot of time to think about life back home. You have a lot of time to think about where you've been, where you're going. My father, from what I understand, was a bit of a lost soul. So I think this was his way of, you know, finding his way as well. So we all kind of came away every year going, yeah, this was good, and this is what Dad would have done. This is what Dad, he would be here if he could. And it was just kind of an agreement that there was nothing negative coming out of these trips at all. It was all good.
What were some of the funnier memories you have from some of these trips that maybe didn't go perfectly?
Well, there's several, and everything from the homemade roof rack we made for the car out of lumber and clothesline to the time where I was going to take the canoe out in the morning for a quick fishing trip and managed to tip over launching the thing and ended up to my neck in water while the rest of the guys were sleeping. So I ended up trying to keep it quiet to where I didn't tip it off that I had tipped it over. And as a result, I got out of the water, put the canoe up, and changed into my dry clothes before anybody got up, and nobody ever knew the difference until I told it in the book. So
should have kept it secret, Jim.
Yep, that's a fact. But there's just so many opportunities in the woods when something goes wrong to laugh at yourself, but also to laugh at others. And that's the important thing out of the book, was you got to be able to take it as well as give it, or else, you know, you'll never make it in a camping environment at any level.
Given how beneficial these trips were and how memorable they were, what then precipitated the end of this tradition?
It actually came about in 1991. I had just married. I think I did one more trip after I was married. Everybody was kind of done with being together for 5 years, and we were all starting our own families and relationships to the point where the wives started having say, and vacation time became a premium, and it kind of just ran its course like many things in life. It was a new chapter, and we just kind of agreed that maybe we'll pick it up again someday, but maybe not. And so it was unfortunate, but I guess we got a lot out of the time we were up there, so it wasn't for naught.
Now, the book is dedicated to your brother, Rob. And in a very moving part of the book, you talk about the last fishing trip you take with Rob. Tell mm-hmm. us about that.
It's hard to put into words without getting all broken up. But it really, he had what was called a celebration of life party, because we knew his condition was terminal. He had cancer, a spinal cancer that they operated on, removed the tumors. A few months later, the tumors came back, and they deemed it spread to his lungs, and it became terminal. So at his celebration of life party, which was a party of about 200 of his closest friends and family, an event that he wanted to do to say goodbye, the question was raised was maybe we could get the brothers out one more time fishing and accommodate him. He was in a wheelchair at the time, and just kind of get the band back together. So we took it upon ourselves to rent a pontoon on White Bear Lake. It's an urban lake right in the Twin Cities. And we had just an awesome, awesome experience with taking him out. He caught the most fish. He caught the first fish. He caught the biggest fish, as it should be. The rest of us were all kind of in the background just catching one here or there. And he just stole the show, and it was just one of those aha moments where you're like, this is what it's all about. So glad I had to do it. It was just such an opportunity to just one more time, do it like we had done it.
What precipitated the decision to start up the tradition again, to resurrect it?
Well, I think part of it with us and this generation that we're raising is they are a bit disconnected from the natural environment. And my brother, as he's head of the DNR, and he's very big into getting kids outdoors again, getting them away from their screens, getting them into the woods and into on the water and fishing and hunting and everything like that. And that's part of our thing is we wanted to pass that love on because it is such a great opportunity to bond with your children, to experience nature, to get in touch with, you know, your inner self, with others. It's just it's almost a mystical kind of experience, and we wanted to share that with our kids.
Why was it important for you to go back there even after the passing of your brother to make sure that this tradition carried on in a new way?
Part of it was to show that we will persevere, that despite all of this adversity we've had in our lives, and we've had a fair amount. My sister died at the age of 5 of a Wilms tumor. My dad died at a young age, and my brother now. And so we just wanted to prove to ourselves that adversity can set us back, but it will not deter us from continuing to try and make a conscious effort to get together as a family and to do the things that Rob would love to do with us. And so it was important that we include his daughter on this last trip again. And we pulled in my nephew, whose father died at a young age too. And so it was funny. I mentioned in the book that they, at one point, the two of them were in what we called the orphan canoe because neither of them had fathers. And they laughed at it. But it was a moving trip in that it was the first one without Rob. So he was on our minds all the time, all of us. And it actually turned out to be just a really great experience, despite the bugs and the rain and whatever that we get every trip.
Well, Jim Landwehr, thank you so much for sharing this memoir with us.
Thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Jim Landwehr's recent book is called Dirty Shirt, A Boundary Waters Memoir. Landwehr lives in Waukesha. He spoke with Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce in an interview which first aired in July. One last break, and then Milwaukee singer-songwriter Peter Mulvey shares a sample of his latest CD in advance of a show this evening in Walker's Point. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee singer-songwriter Peter Mulvey's first 15 albums have spanned a range of styles, from introspective, quiet acoustic songs to more fully produced rock songs. His 16th and latest album, Silver Ladder, released this spring, falls into that second camp, but the full band accompaniment strays into some territory that gives it a distinct sound even within Mulvey's rich discography. That's thanks in large part to the influence of producer Chuck Prophet. Mulvey plays a show this evening at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point, but back when the album first came out, he joined us for a solo set in Performance Studio C1, starting with the song You Don't Have to Tell Me.
You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. I already know. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. I already know. No, you don't have to tell me. I already know.
Peter Mulvey, You Don't Have to Tell Me, in Studio C1. Peter Mulvey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Good to be here. Good to be here, Mitch.
It is good to see you again, and exciting that you have this new record out. It's a much more textured, more complex album, at least in terms of the arrangement. I don't want to say your writing is not complex in the previous stuff, but it is. Some of your more recent stuff is more stripped down than this. On the other hand, it's not like you've never worked with a full band before. Are you exercising a different songwriting muscle when you bring together a group of people to put together something like this?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've been writing a lot lately. The past couple of years, I've been writing a song every Tuesday, and I knew that I wanted to make just sort of a knockdown, drag out kind of a record. And so you do, you sort of, It's more that you just put that in the back of your mind, and then your what muse, whatever you want to call it, coughs up some rock and roll tunes. But I will say, Chuck Prophet produced this record, and he took it all in direct. I mean, he practically rewrote some of the tunes. It was startling.
Well, yeah. So you had Chuck Prophet as the producer on this. He's a name that some people probably recognize. Others might not. What made him the right guy for the job?
Oh, man. Because he's incredibly contrary. He's an old school rock and roller. He's like the last guy out there with a rock and roll band, sort of, you know, taking no prisoners and delivering, he's just the greatest. And I'd met him and opened a gig for him in Florida back on the road 4 or 5 years. And I called him up, and just his answer, I said, "Hey man, I love what you do. Would you produce my record?" And he was like, "Sure, it could happen. What's your budget?" And I was like, I got $12,000, which was a lie. And he was like, "Well, then we're going to be savvy, champion. That's what's going to happen." Like, and that's the way he was the whole way through. It was like working with a crocodile on Ritalin. Like, if you come to him and say, "Okay, aesthetic choice A or B," he's like, "Why does it have to be a letter, pal? It could be a number. It could be five. It could be blue. This thing could be a bird. If it's the right bird, this tune could be flying by next Tuesday." Awesome.
It sounds kind of Confucian.
he was like the Zen monk that like torments you until you have a breakthrough. I spent the first night of the sessions, we made the record in LA and he put the band together. I spent the first night just lying awake thinking, I have made the largest mistake of this year. And then in the morning I realized he's not being argumentative because he wants to win, and he's not being argumentative for its own sake. It actually is like those old Zen monks. The argumentation gives rise to desperation, which gives rise to new ideas. It's a way to work. I'd never done it before.
Well, you know, and at the stage of your career, do you look for something different in a producer in the whole production process than you did when you were younger? I mean, you're not looking for I don't know what you were looking for when, you know, you were writing your first songs years ago. But when you go to somebody like Chuck Prophet, you have to kind of expect something else.
Yeah. The truth is, I think I probably spent the first 15 years of making records with producers learning. And now I'm unlearning, if that makes sense. You build yourself an aesthetic and you build yourself something you're comfortable with. But of course, you got to knock it down. And boy, howdy, I guess I picked the right guy for this one, you know?
Is it harder to relinquish control over what comes out of a song at this stage in your career? I mean, you have... you know, umpteen hundred songs under your belt. It takes a certain amount of confidence, I would think, in the process to say, okay, I've written this, take it from here.
Yeah, it depends on the tune. The ones that came personal to me, the ones that are closest to my heart, those I still had a tendency to argue for. But I would say with the rest of them, the ones where I'm just, you know, where I'm writing what comes in and I'm not thinking about it too hard, it's actually easier than it used to be because, you know, now I've got, what is this, my 16th record, and I have well over 100, probably closing on 200 songs out there. And you start to realize that there's no such thing as the perfect iteration of a song. It lives out there and it breathes. That's what it's for.
You said you're writing a song every Tuesday.
Yeah.
Which makes it good. We're having this conversation on a Wednesday, so I'm glad we're not interrupting. How does that work?
Well, I have two dear old friends, funny enough, that are both originally from the Milwaukee scene here. My old friend Joe Panzetta, I was in a band with him 20-some years ago, and Pamela Means, who's still out there on the road. And we're all still out there, and we just have reconnected. And basically, the assignment is, on Tuesday, at the end of the day, you got to send in a song. And it can be fragmentary. It can be downright mediocre. But you have to send it or you have to send guilt. You know, like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't, but I'm. And it's been really fruitful. Your batting average goes down a little bit, as it were, you know, probably only a quarter of what I turn in is any good. But still, that's upwards of a dozen songs that I can keep and put on records a year. So
you're getting more at bats.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also it takes the pressure off. I think the stupidest question you can ask as an artist is, what do I have to say? Nobody has anything to say. And even if they do, it's been said, and it's been said better by a greater artist earlier. But that's fine, because it's not a very useful question, what do I have to say? What's a very useful question is, what is interesting to me in this moment? What's the most interesting thing I can think of? What's the most exciting sound I can make now because I'm required to make a sound, you know?
And this does not keep you from writing on a Wednesday or a Friday or a Sunday.
No, and quite often I've had like a tune on a come along on a Thursday sort of randomly and then thought, well, I'll just send that on Tuesday. And then I think, no. Actually, no. I'm supposed to write a song this Tuesday. So it's been good. It's been good.
Well, I want to ask you when you wrote the next song you're going to play for us, but I will ask you to introduce it. What are you going to play for us?
Sure. I wrote this on a week that I had a dare to write a song every day. So this tune is called Lies You Forgot You Told.
I gave you fruit from the desert, a pocket full of stars, a glamour from the eyes of a saint. I gave you roses by the bunches and my very best hunches about everything that isn't and ain't. With any kind of look by now, it's falling on your head tenfold. A fool for believing lies you forgot you told. When you begged and you pleaded, I spoke the words you needed, although every single one burnt my tongue. I gave you faith when it deserted you, and kisses till it hurt. Climbed the silver ladder to the very top of rung, and with any kind of luck by now, it will be falling on your head tenfold. I'm a fool for believing lies I knew all along, oh, I knew all along, and I knew all along, I knew all along, oh, whoa, oh, 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 oh. I gave you handwriting and tears, an antidote to fears, a plumb line to the bottom of the well. When you asked about my secret book, I showed you every page, at least I think I did, you never can tell. Any kind of luck right now is falling on your head tenfold. I'm a fool for believing lies. Any kind of luck right now, it will be falling on your head tenfold. I'm such a fool for believing lies you forgot you told.
Awesome.
Thank you.
To use a maybe overused word, but it was great.
Thank you.
Peter Mulvey with Lies You Forgot You Told. That is the song that kicks off this new album.
That is, yeah.
And also the album itself gets its name from a lyric there, Silver Ladder.
Yeah, it does.
What was the catalyst for the album as a whole? I mean, you've been writing all of these songs, but when did and maybe why did you say, okay, this is when this album starts?
I think it all – I mean, it all began actually quite a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. You know, I just went through some pretty ordinary stuff. A good friend of mine died. A couple good friends of mine died. A couple of relationships near me busted up and, you know, and my cat died. And it doesn't take that much. I mean, I think we tend to think of ourselves as pretty – our personality is a pretty stable edifice. But, you know, that pretty much did me in and I came unstuck. And when I got out of the other side of the woods, because there always seems to be another side, you know, we heal. We just do what we do. I just felt like, all right, I want to write. Like, this is a short ride. This is a real short ride. I've had that demonstrated to me. Let's have some fun. Let's write some rock and roll tunes. And the first two tunes that announced themselves, one was called What Else Was It? And another was called Trempolo. And they came in – I mean, I've had a long career as a writer, and you really – these really feel good when they come in this way. It's like they're being beamed in on the radio. They feel like they're coming from somewhere else. And once I had those, I thought, all right, I can build a record around these. And I just went to work.
Rough spells can be inhibiting, but they can also be energizing. Is there a way that you learn to use a challenge in one part of your life to your advantage in another part?
I think everyone has an instinct for that, and everyone does it in a different way. I have a very good friend, Jeffrey Foucault. You've had him on a show many times. And when I was kind of down in the storm, he said, now is when you need to be writing. I remember him sending me an email about that, and I sent him a very brief email back saying, I can't. But in my case, I felt like I had my hooks in the water the whole time while you're down there, and I feel like I managed to drag whatever it was up with me. So everyone's got their way, and that appears to be mine. It seems to be a delayed reaction for me, and that's fine. It's all good.
Yeah, you know, it always strikes me in listening to music, and maybe it's not that different a phenomenon than in fiction or poetry or even painting, that you have this little snapshot of whatever life was like for you at a certain point in time. But a writer or a painter doesn't have to perform that part of his life over and over again. Do you have to consciously guard against writing, I don't know, the open wound song? Do you have to be on the out of those woods before you can actually say,
yeah,
this is an emotion that I have nailed here?
Yeah, that's a pertinent question. I think that for me, that kind of just takes care of itself. And to me, it's a little like being an actor. I think actors are some of the only other artists that do that thing where you're recreating a moment, and you might be, in my case, I'm singing the same words and playing the same chords every night, but I'm trying to make it alive and pertinent and present. You know, and similarly, an actor who is playing any role, they're saying the same words every night, but that's not what we're coming to see. We didn't come to see them do something they memorized. We're coming to see them have an experience. So you are sort of calling it up. And over time, you just get good at it, and it doesn't really bother me. I don't feel like I carry it home, and when I, you know. So this, although the tunes of this record came from a pretty rough place, I feel great.
Congratulations! It's great stuff.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And what will you leave us with?
Oh, this is a tune that I co-wrote with the great Paul Sebar. This is called "Back in the Wind."
Milwaukee singer-songwriter Peter Mulvey's latest album is called Silver Ladder. He'll play a show this evening at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point on a bill with Milwaukee's Hayward Williams, who is in residency there through August. We spoke with Peter Mulvey in May. That's all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great to have you listening today, as it is every day. Sure hope you can join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Work it all through and back again. Putting out time with labor down in. How long it gonna be? Till we're back in the wind. Some kind of sedative slipped into it, passes for my higher mind.